Hello, welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea, Ryan Gibson here. Happy tax day, or right about there. Ryan, how you doing, man?
Which is right around my birthday, which is April 16th every year, so...
Hey, happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you, thank you. You know, this show is always the best because, you know, we get to go on and tell everybody, like, answers to their question, which everybody's... Any passive investors that are listening to this is probably wondering, where's my K-1? You know, where's my K-1? So we're actually going to answer why you don't really, that you might not need your K-1 to file your taxes. And that we'll get to that at the end of the show.
That's right.
So we're not going to give you the answer. You got to listen all the way to the end.
Yeah. Really great tip there.
Yeah.
So today we've got Nathan Sosa from Hall CPA. Nathan's been with us a couple times. He's got a master's of taxation, lives in Oil Country in Oklahoma, and is actually one of the CPAs that I personally work with. Absolutely fantastic. We're going to talk all about the new tax laws and paying less tax, all these little tips, tricks, nuggets that can help you pay less to the IRS.
I love it.
What are you working on lately, Ryan?
Yeah, well, you know, we actually are raising capital for our next deal in Colorado. I just talked to a United guy this morning, actually, who listens to the show on his commute up to there. We're actually buying, it's kind of cool, we're buying two properties right by the U.S. Air Force Academy, the in Colorado Springs, and we're buying one in Castle Rock, Colorado. And so pretty excited to be buying two self-storage facilities there. And one of them has an industrial flex component to it, which is really, nice. Really cool. Yeah, awesome deal. Mom and pop seller, perfect thing. So we've been working on that, been hard getting after that and getting those underway. So
that's amazing. Well, we're going to have to stop by. We're doing an investor event out at 4 Mile Ranch in August. At the golf course that we own. So maybe have to swing through. We always go through Colorado Springs. I always love touring some property on the way down there.
We should do like a bus tour or something, you know, go see a couple self-storage facilities, go to your golf course. I mean,
you have the coolest investment
down there, you know, so.
It's pretty cool. The St. Cloud Hotel just reopened. It was a hotel that was built in the 1800s. They just did this beautiful renovation on it. And our golf course, our 18-hole golf course there is it's a gem. It was built by Jim Ng, designed by Jim Ng. And it's a really, really fun course to play. So anyway.
All right. Well, we want to get to some tax tips. I know to these pilots, we're desperate for anything that we can do to mitigate our tax strategies. So let's get into it.
Let's get into it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Nathan, thanks so much for coming back onto the show. Good to see you again.
Great to be back, guys. Always love having conversations with us here. Like we had to stop what we were doing before this podcast. We should always have like fun banter beforehand. It's like, stop, we're going to record now and jump in.
Yeah, we got to record this. It's good stuff. I know. We were laughing before we hit record that I can't believe that we're recording a podcast with you on April 9th.
No kidding.
that's suicide for you. So thanks for your time.
Of course, guys. Glad to be on.
But Nathan, we've had you on and a couple times. We talked about opportunity zones in episode 92. We talked about the new tax bill in 2025. We did a deep dive, episode 118. You know, I think what's interesting is always when these new tax bills come out, there's sort of like the problems that you have to deal with during tax season. And there's like things that no longer apply, things that do apply. And I think, you know, we wanted to bring you on in your busiest time of the year, of course. Thanks for doing that. You know, kind of in the flux of all this change, you know, we want pilots to kind of understand like kind of a state of the tax world, you know, like what's going on, what's new. Because I think a lot of listeners may have listened to your episode late in the year last year and we're like, oh my God, I don't have time to do any of these like things that you're talking about to help me save taxes. And so now it's April and now they have plenty of time to do something in 2026 to change their tax situation. Let's start with that. Let's just start with kind of the state of the tax world and kind of what you see as you prepare those returns this year that are different than last year.
Yeah, no, definitely. I appreciate that, Ryan. Yeah. So like, it's like, there could be potential things they could do on 2025 too, even, right? It's like, as long as they don't file quite yet, right? As long as you get that little extension in taken care of. But yeah, so state of the tax world, right? Everyone, I'd be shocked if anyone didn't hear, you'd live under a rock if you didn't hear about the one big beautiful bill and all the big beautiful things that came out of it, specifically bonus depreciation, right? That's the big one that everyone's the biggest fan of. If you're a real estate investor or interested in real estate, that's going to be your biggest boon. Why? Because you can use those depreciate, because depending on different tax strategies you utilize, right? We were stuck at 60%, and then it was going to, then it turned up into, it's going to go down to 40%, right? And oddly right. enough,
phasing out from yeah. the 2017 Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
Right. And every single time bonus is about to step down to 40%, Congress decides that they need to step up and jump in. And so they restored that to 100%. Thankfully, this time it'll never go to 40% ever again, because it's permanently stuck at 100% bonus. Until somebody else writes a new tax law. So we'll see what happens in 2029, right? But we'll find out what happens when that comes. But basically, the state of tax world, we've seen a lot of people come off the sidelines in terms of capital. We have seen some unfortunate people who, you know, had something in 2024 that they wanted to then decide to turn into a short-term rental that wasn't a short-term rental before. Fortunately, those people are not able to use 100% bonus just because of the ways the rules are written.
Yeah, it was when it was placed in service, right? So correct. If you placed it in service during the phase out period, you're kind of stuck with that phase out.
Yeah. Anything before January 19th, you're stuck on the phase out schedule. Everything after January 20th going forward, you're good on the phase. You're actually good on the good side of the 100% bonus appreciation.
What if you own something that you bought during the phase out period, but you didn't place it into service? Let's say you bought a primary residence and you were going to convert it to a short-term rental and turn it into a rental property. How does that work?
Yeah, so those are the people who are unfortunately hearing my 40% bonus depreciation news, right? Okay. I'm sorry. That's just the way the rules are written. It has to be acquired and placed in service is what the letter of the law basically says.
Good advice. Yeah, and one thing that we were catching up on before the show, it was this alternative minimum tax. And I know that I was probably confused on what that was in the first place, even before they phased it out. But can you talk about AMT and kind of what it was and how it's not applicable anymore, or is it applicable?
Yeah, so the AMT is possibly one of the most confusing pieces of tax legislation out there. And thankfully, they got rid of it back in 2017. And like I say got rid of it, that's probably like if another CPA is listening to this, they're going to go, oh, that's not true. But it technically still exists, but they changed it up enough that it applies to almost nobody, right? If you've got a spouse, maybe if you're a pilot and you have a spouse that works in like private equity and gets some like ISO, gets some like incentive stock options, maybe this might apply to you. And there's like some credits involved there that could potentially happen. But for the most part, AMT is gone for everybody. And anybody that's a real estate investor too doesn't really apply all that often anymore.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, great to hear.
So what are some of the more complicated things that might have come in and replaced it? Yeah, I mean, if you're bumping up into that 35-37% tax bracket, are there additional taxes that kick in like the AMT did, where it kind of limits your write-offs?
So nothing that limits your write-offs per se, but it's a good question, Tate. We were talking about the net investment income tax a little bit before the show, and that is a tax that does kick in if you're in that 35-37% bracket. That tax does kick in for you, right? Once you're making over, I believe, around $250,000, once you get over that threshold, that's when NIT starts kicking. And what is that again? I keep saying NIT. I need to say net investment income tax. Right. Okay. It's a relatively newer provision. I say newer because only 13 years old, which is very young for the tax code. But basically it says anything that you consider to be what we all would consider to be quote unquote passive income, which is anything that we don't quote unquote materially participate in, which is a lot of tax language for just saying things you don't are involved in, or portfolio interest, stock, et cetera, capital gains.
Right. Passive real estate deals. And actually also your rentals, unfortunately, yes. Unless you're a real estate professional, are passive.
Correct. 100%. Yep. That's who that applies to. Now, if you have depreciation, you're probably not getting taxed on that. But if you've got a really great cash flowing opportunity and not a lot of depreciation, that could apply to you and could hit you in this case. And so that's when we can do some strategic things. And here's what actually I gave like a webinar a couple of weeks ago just about the conversation of NIT. And I actually have seen it apply in a lot of situations where it shouldn't.
Interesting. So can you maybe give us an example?
Yeah. So basically, let's say that you are a real estate professional and that you then go, so it all gets reported on a form 8960. That's where the net investment income tax lives basically and says, hey, this is the breakout and calculation of what the tax that applies. And so what I recommend to anybody who has a tax return is go to that form and it'll tell you how much you're getting taxed on dividends, interest, capital gains. And then if you see real estate or you have a business or something like that, and you're getting taxed on that and you're like, hold on, I did real estate professional status, short-term rental strategy, all that stuff. Why am I getting taxed on this? That's a good question you should go ask your CPA for, because it's just a check of the box. However, we're human beings. Sometimes we forget to check those boxes. And that means you could be paying over, you could be paying lots of money in tax that you shouldn't be. I've actually seen someone who paid over $1 million over 10 years in net tax that never needed to be paid, actually.
Oof. What's the remediation on that? Like if you look at 10 years of tax returns, how far can you go back and amend?
You can only go, so that's a, this part stinks a little bit. You can only go back to 3 years, right? So let's say if you file on April 15th, you can go back 3 years, and that's the farthest back. So 2020, so if you filed in 2022, your tax return, and you filed it on April 15th, that is the, well, actually, yeah, that's the farthest back we can go right now, right? We can go back 3 years returns. That's the farthest, but it's only 3 years. So that means the other seven were just SOL, unfortunately. There's nothing we can do there.
If you haven't filed your returns yet and you filed an extension, can you go back an additional year?
It all depends on the year you've, so it all depends on the year you filed, right? So if you did file an extension, right? Let's say 2022, for like 2022, for example, in that case, and you filed the extension, you probably have more time. So you could have someone look at that this summer. If you notice that mistake on the tax return, then you could go back and take a look there.
Interesting.
Nathan, as you kind of go through the new tax regime that we're in, right? What are some things that you're, that are surprising clients? Like I thought that this big, beautiful tax bill did one thing, but you're saying, but you're having to explain to them, no, that's not what they meant about that. Or what are some surprises that people are coming across?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. So some surprises were, so it's like one, for example, is like people saying, oh, I'm going to get 100% bonus depreciation and then not winding up getting it because they purchased a property in 2024, placed it in service in 2025. That's one example. See other people saying, oh, great, I'm going to get increased SALT income tax deduction. And it's like, well, actually, your income is like you're way over the threshold. And regardless of any planning we could have done, it, like you're just too high up there. We have to find a lot of deductions to get you down into like that sweet salty spot.
That makes a lot of sense.
SALT means, just for anybody who's not tracking?
State local income tax, right? So basically, state income taxes you pay, real estate property taxes you pay on your personal residence.
Excellent. Thanks.
And so that SALT cap is scheduled to, for reversion in 2030, and there's phase outs above 500K. Is that my understanding?
Correct. Yeah, you're totally right on that. So basically, like this is what I call the salty spot, right? Because once we get over, I know, right? But basically, when we get to $500,000 is a sweet spot, because if you $500,000 or less, you basically get to deduct. Okay, let's do a refresh, actually. Let's talk about what it used to be. So it used to be, back in 2017, they tossed this cap on state and local income taxes. You only deduct up to $10,000, which actually limited a lot of people. A lot of people stopped being able to itemize. What is itemizing? Basically, if you take your combination of state and local income taxes, your mortgage interest, and charitable contributions, all put all three of those together, over basically $30,000, you get additional tax deductions. Congratulations. But when you toss this 10K on top of it, nobody gets there anymore. But that changed in 2025. So now most people, a lot of people, especially 35%, 37% high income earners, W-2 pilots, for example, actually are getting back to that level again, and they're getting to maximize it. However, once you get to 500K, that's when you start getting, have it shaved down bit by bit by bit. And the max is actually at 600,000, right? So basically, if you can get your taxable income, is what I'll call it. It's a little bit different for tax, but basically get it down to 500,000, you actually save yourself. You've gained $30,000 in deductions, which turns into $10,000 in tax savings.
So that's massive, right? And if you're listening to this, you know, a light bulb might be going off that if you're making $600,000 for this year and you're in, let's say, the 35% tax bracket, because I think the 37% kicks in as a married couple above like 600 and something. You know, you're not actually saving 35 cents on the dollar. You're saving even more with whatever those write-offs are, right? Because the state and local tax deductions start to kick back in. Is that right?
Precisely. Yeah, you're 100% correct there.
So this is massive for anybody that's picking up, you know, green slips, double time. You know, if you're out there and you're making big money, I mean, it's wild how much, you know, how much gets taken out of those last dollars. And if you can get it, you get these write-offs that can get you down to that, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 range, like you said, that's the sweet spot, right? You still qualify for all your loans. You know, you're still showing that you're making income for the banks, which they like, and you're not wasting deductions on the lower tax brackets. Is there anything else that people should be looking out for?
You know, I think people should be considering, at least who are close to that, like to that salty sweet spot, is like, I can, this one's, it's really minor and small. It's just something, it's something I do personally too. It's just like bunching charitable contributions, right? If you give to a church, synagogue, whatever religious, or any religious activity, or just like, let's be honest, any 501c3s, right? That's something that you believe that you should be giving, right? I recommend bunching your deductions together. And what that means, long story short. Yeah. Long story short, basically instead, like, let's say a tithe is a general, is a really general one. Do 10% of your income. So instead of doing 10% one year, you do 20% every other year. Right. And so that actually gets you right over the threshold when you normally might not be able to. Normally I wouldn't be able to get over that $30,000. If you take my combo of state and local income taxes and my mortgage interest and my normal 10% charity. But if I do 20%, it actually gets me over. Saves me $2,500, right? I mean, it's not massive. It's a small win, but something I'll take. I won't say no to an extra $2,500 just with additional tax planning.
That's where the tax planning really comes in, because that's not something that someone would be thinking about. You know, if they're planning on giving to charity anyway, it's like, hey, if you do it this way, it's going to be, you know, a little bit more tax efficient. That's incredible. I mean, that's why we do advanced tax strategy planning, right?
100%. Yeah. It's just about being efficient with our deductions. That's always the goal.
Right.
Nathan, you've worked with our pilots, our listeners on the show now for probably the better part of 2 years. You know, a lot of people go to Hall CPAs that listen to the show. Can you kind of give us sort of the top things that pilots are doing differently on their taxes that maybe they weren't doing differently before that are helping them save on their taxes? I mean, because I know a lot of pilots like really struggle to find this answer. Like, how do I save money? I'm making more money. I'm paying more taxes than I've ever paid. But you've actually seen our listeners and their tax returns and helped them strategize and prepare for how to do that return better. So what are some of the biggest things that you've seen in the last couple of years?
Yeah. So the number one thing that I'm seeing on that end is short-term rental strategy. That's number one that I'm seeing right now. And it's basically, what is that? I mean, I'm sure this, it's been on the show plenty of times at this point, but we'll go through it one more time. Is basically go find a property that's a good vacation type rental, something like that. It can be in a just like, you know, a drive-by type area too, where you think like, hey, someone needs to stop for the night. Absolutely an opportunity, but you're going to do better cash flow wise if you do like more vacation type. And so you go invest in that piece of real estate. And then once you do that, you materially participate. What does that even mean? Basically, you actively run and manage that short-term rental. You do that. Then after you do that for a couple months, maybe the whole entire year, just depends, right? Like this is where the planning comes into play. But you do that, then you get a cost segregation on that property. That's where the big, beautiful bonus depreciation comes into play. And yep, you get to write off a massive chunk of that and get $30,000 to $50,000 plus of tax savings.
That's amazing. Yeah.
We've seen it in action. It's something I do. I want to clarify, the material participation is separate from the whole real estate professional stuff.
Correct.
You've probably heard us talk about this on the show many, many times, but to recap, real estate professional status is a little bit more difficult to get, 750 hours, and you have to spend more time doing real estate related activities than you do in your day job. That does also work though, if your spouse is going to get rep status and you just fly. That's a good strategy, but it's a lot of work and it's a lot of logging. 750 hours plus is a lot of time to keep track of throughout the year. The short-term rental strategy is just 100 hours, but that entire 100 hours has to be on that single property. And it means that the deductions that you're going to get that are active against your W-2 are only going to be associated with that one property. That's the short term, right? So it doesn't blanket everything, all your real estate, and say all your real estate can be deductible against a W-2, but it does mean that that specific short-term rental that you bought this year, you're going to be able to take the cost seg and bonus depreciation on that against your W-2. We have a place that we're closing on in June, doing that exact strategy. It's a ski in, ski out villa in southern Utah, at pretty good price on it, brand new build. And Nathan, you're going to be seeing that cost seg come across your desk next year.
Let's go, Tate. Nice. Hold on. Guys, I think we're missing a great business idea here, potentially, is that we need to find a way to make a dating site for pilots and then real estate brokers and match them together. We'll do a matchmaking site. You got a real estate professional over here, got a high income pilot, and we'll just match you guys together. I think we're missing a business opportunity.
Right. As everybody knows, my wife, Lucy, is a realtor. So, it's a match made in heaven.
Actually, I didn't think about that. That's hilarious. Yeah.
yeah. That's right. We need pilots and real estate professionals that can, the dating app. I love that.
Nathan, let's talk about, the short-term rental is well known on the show. What is something maybe a little less known that has kind of maybe surprised the pilots being like, oh, I didn't even realize these guys haven't even talked about that on the show?
Yeah, that's a good point. One that has been talked about on the show, but it just hasn't been as that I think people are not always totally aware of, is oil and gas, right? Is making oil and gas investments. Actually, that's one that I think a lot of folks, they're very focused on real estate, and it's a great investment. So I don't want to steer anybody away from that. But oil and gas is another opportunity too, where that you get to actually, so we talked about all the work you have to do in a short-term rental and for real estate professional status. Oil and gas is the opposite. You just have to invest, and then you get these great tax benefits coming back to you at the same time.
Yeah, this section 263C is that even if you do not materially participate in oil and gas, you still get to count it as an active write-off, right? And these were rules written all the way back in the 50s, right?
Oh, yeah. The government clearly wants people to invest into these types of things, right? They want to make these investments because that's how your car goes, right? It's how you get it's how you get your house heated, right? That type of stuff. Not that we need that right now in April, but regardless, that's precisely how we people want to make these investments, right? The only quote unquote downside is that you have to invest in your personal name. Can't do it via an LLC. It's the only difference here. But I'll say is not an attorney. I've heard the downside is not that high in those cases.
Yeah, that's great.
Amazing. Love that strategy. I could talk all day about that, but I want to keep this tax focused. So let's talk about limited partner positions in real estate deals, because I know a lot of our listeners invest passively in real estate. What are some gotchas? What are some surprises that people see when they get their first K-1 and they either put it into TurboTax or they give it to you? And what surprises them?
So shockingly, not just passive, not just pilots, other really large entrepreneurs that I talk to go, yeah, the whole time I get to write off this depreciation, right? And then you say, actually, unfortunately, you don't get to, right? And though they've factored that in, they're like their own brain, their own tax planning, they toss it into Claude, right? They're talking to Claude and trying to figure it out. And Claude's like, yeah, totally. You're going to know fine. You're going to write it off. And then it goes, oh, actually at tax time, it's not the case, unfortunately. So that's actually the biggest gotcha that you wind up seeing. Another gotcha you sometimes see too is people go, well, they see this capital count at the bottom and they say it's negative. That's bad, right? And it's it's actually not a big deal at all, right? That's just kind of common. That can happen in real estate deals. Not all the time, but it can happen. So that's one quote unquote gotcha I see. The gotchas you see later on is potentially when you have maybe there's some thankfully it doesn't happen very often. But it can happen is where you get quote unquote phantom gain. What is that? Well, basically where you're taking it, where potentially you are getting taxed on income that you didn't technically receive. There's a lot of disparity that people have questions on when it comes to this. To say, well, I got $15,000 of cash from the real estate syndication, but it shows that I have this income, right? And it's higher than my distribution amount. Why is that? What's the difference here? Why is that different? And the reason is because the other quote unquote $15,000 of cash is actually in the real estate business being used, deployed, et cetera, right? Across. That's why you're just taxing the overall, right? Versus technically what distributions are.
I'll give you an extreme example. Let's look at a hypothetical real estate fund where you're going to recycle all of the profits into more real estate. That would be an example where it's a profitable fund, but none of the profits were distributed out to investors. They went to go and buy more real estate, right? So you could imagine a scenario where you got a K-1 that shows, $30,000 worth of gains. You're like, wait a minute, I didn't see $30,000. You have to pay taxes on that, right? So all the deals that I've seen try their best to distribute at least enough to cover the tax. They'll distribute 52% of profits because that's the highest state and federal bracket that you'll end up in. But anyway, it's not a huge red flag. It's just, something you need to be aware of if that's the strategy of the fund that you're investing in.
There's also another spot that you're probably going to get taxed on that you can't depreciate against. At least, Nathan, correct me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding, box 5, right? So if you actually have interest income on your K-1, that's a gotcha too. So like, I'll give you a great example. You know, this was actually, you know, Tate and I, when we put out our disclaimers, you know, there's pages and pages and pages of disclaimers. I hate to say it, but
right.
But some of those all of those disclaimers have meaning. And this is what you learn over the last decade of investing, right? And one of those things is that it's probably going to say in there is that something to this effect, where this might generate tax liability outside of the distributable cash. And I think investors need to go into this eyes wide open. And one of the things that hit us this past year was we have really high interest bearing accounts for our idle cash. So when investors put money with us, you know, they go into interest-bearing checking accounts, and that interest-bearing checking accounts gets taxed, right? So you have to report that in your tax return. And so the pro rata amount of interest that's earned on these investments has to be allocated to the investors. So like, for example, I mean, we made so much interest income on one deal. I mean, there was as much as like $1,500 of interest income, you know, distributed to an investor. I'm looking at the K-1 right now that had like, he had $200K in the deal, and there was $1,494 of interest income on a deal that was a ground up development, because like all the cash came in right. And the cash sat there, millions and millions of dollars accumulating interest. But of course the facility's not open yet. So there might be a little interest income. We are so in the weeds right now, but I just wanted to, you know, I mean, it's a thing out there, right? Like you may have income that you haven't realized that might become taxed. It's not a terrible thing. Because at the end of the day, like that interest income went back into your deal and made your deal like lose less money or make more money, right? Like that deal went to your thing that you're building, right? So it's still a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's something to be aware of.
No, it's if you want to go deeper in the weeds, we can definitely do that.
Let's keep going. Let's go down a layer.
So a lot of times, so if, let's say that like you're talking about like we're a build-up construction, right? And so we have to ask the question, a lot of times these deals are not fully done by cash from investors and GPs. They're done by debt. Mm-hmm. And so right. A lot of that time you get to take the debt couldn't be deployed. So it goes and gets shoved into that account that you're talking about that creates the interest income. Well, there's different types of interest expenses that exist out there. One of the ones that winds up being is called investment interest expense. And so when the IRS goes, cool, I want to see where everything flowed. And you say, well, yeah, we shoved a chunk of that into a interest-bearing account, say a savings account. They go, great. That's not business interest then. That's investment interest.
So this is, you're saying, let's say Spartan is building a ground-up self-storage deal and they close on a construction loan, and rather than taking draws from the lender, they just get it all in one chunk and it sits in account-bearing interest. And it's essentially they're paying interest, but they're also making interest on the balance at the same time?
Yep, precisely.
Okay.
And so what's beneficial here is what we're talking about is like, okay, normally you can't deduct that interest, right? Because it's like, because you wouldn't be able to deduct the interest income. But in this scenario, because a portion of that should be classified as investment interest expense, that means if you have that on the other side, on your 1040, on a form 4952, you get to take that deduction actually. And it's actually better for you because you would otherwise be passive. Long rabbit trail to get to, but basically you do get to take advantage of this.
Yeah.
All right. I want to come out of left field with a little bit of an off topic question. And that is that, you know, a lot of times pilots, you know, will reach out. I get this constantly, you know, reaching out saying, you know, hey, I need a good CPA recommendation. And then they'll have a call and it's like, okay, well, it's going to be $5,000 for the year for forward looking tax strategy. And they go, whoa, that's a little more than I want to spend, which is fine. That's totally cool. But where do you see, like, when should someone get off of TurboTax and start talking to someone like yourself?
Great question, Tate. I would say the moment that you are personally acquiring real estate for yourself, right? The moment that you do
that. So not K-1s. So K-1s are easy. TurboTax handles them just fine.
I would say typically, yeah, if you're a limited partner, right? That's different if you're operating a business, right? And like you've got a partnership. But if you're a limited partner, I think it's still fine to do TurboTax in those situations. You can call someone up and get a consult.
What about with oil and gas? If they're investing in some oil and gas stuff and there's some IDC write-offs?
I would probably get an accountant at that point in time. I think that changes. I think that flips the switch too at that point in time to make sure everything's being reported correctly and you actually are like game planning for different scenarios in the future.
Right.
Yeah, I love that. Because you probably get these calls all the time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just talk to a guy, brand new United pilot. I just got hired, was in the military, and you know, doing some real estate deals. I'm sure you talked to the same person, and you know, he's like, "What do I do? Tell me what to do." And I'm like, "You're doing the right thing. You're getting educated, right?
Exactly.
You're getting around the right people, and you're calling me to take action, right?" So, but sometimes the tax part of it is just you're not ready yet. You don't need a big time firm.
Exactly.
To do your thing yet. And, you know, I just love that question because I get it. I mean, I literally just hung up the phone and was talking to somebody about, hey, look, maybe next year, maybe when you start getting some rentals, you know, think about that, but don't have too much analysis paralysis around, you know, who to use for your CPA. So.
All right. We're kind of keeping on the theme of passive real estate deals. I want to kind of talk about when these things go full cycle, because sometimes people, you know, get enamored with the tax benefits and the write-offs and just going back to those K-1 losses that you might see on a real estate K-1, not going to be able to use that against your W-2 because it's a passive loss. And so it's only going to be able to offset passive income. So for pilots out there that are listening, if you have profitable rentals in your portfolio, bingo, you know, your K-1 is now useful to you. But Nathan, I'm sure you see a lot of pilots who, you know, don't have a whole lot of use for those losses and they just carry forward from year to year as a suspended loss. What happens when that deal goes full cycle, sells, and they actually make a bunch of money? And now all of a sudden they have a capital gains tax problem on top of making all this W-2 income. So what does that look like for people?
Yeah. So actually, this is a great benefit because in the tax code, it basically says, all right, you can't use these passive losses until you have a disposition of property. What that means is, when a fund goes full cycle, when you sell a property, all those losses get released. And now the passive loss rules don't apply any longer. And that is actually an ordinary loss. That's not a capital loss. It's not a passive loss any longer, right? It's an ordinary loss. And so what happens then is it's supposed to go offset ordinary income, not capital gains.
This is one of the biggest nuggets that I've ever heard. We first heard it back from Toby Mathis way back on episode, I don't know, 12 or 14 or something like that, 10 or 14. And this blew my mind because you'd think that it would go to chase down, you know, you have this leftover loss that you didn't use and the deal went 3 or 5 years or whatever. And then it sells and you get, you know, you put in $100,000 and you're getting $200,000 back, but you've got a 50K K-1 loss from the depreciation that you never used. You would think that it would just sort of neutralize out, right? It would just kill some of your capital gains tax. It doesn't. So Nathan, you want to just say that again, please, because that 50K loss, let's say you didn't touch a dollar of it. You couldn't use it the whole time.
Right. And so you're right, Tate. It doesn't help with the capital gain at all, unfortunately, right? That's 20%, 23.8%. And you include that net investment income tax we talked about earlier. Actually, what it goes to is offsets your super high tax W-2. Right at the top, yes. That 37% bracket. That's where it really helps out. What's even better, actually, we see this happen a lot, is let's say you're in 5 syndications, right? You've got 150,000 of passive activity losses stored up. And one of them produces $100,000 of gain and goes full cycle, right? That actually frees up a lot of the passive activity losses of that amount to go and eat all of that gain and actually offset your W-2 as well. So it's just a massive play. It's like it's one of those things, like everything in tax is a timing difference. But at some point in time, you're going to get to take advantage of the timing difference.
This is one of those reasons why you want to have somebody good on your team when you start to get more sophisticated. Because as these things start to come up, you might want to be saying, okay, hey, this thing just came full cycle. Let's take a look at it. How is this going to affect my tax situation? And this is ahead of time, right? So this is like tax planning today or in October for 2026 tax filing season, which is going to happen a year from now. And look at, okay, how is this going to affect it? And if it's going to hit me negatively, what do I need to do with these proceeds in order to mitigate the capital gain that I'm getting hit with? Do I need to go and buy another short-term rental? Maybe you made a really nice return on your syndication deal and you're like, I'm going to go buy a lake house to make it a short-term rental. Or I'm going to plow it back into another syndication deal, which will generate fresh losses, sort of quote unquote lazy man's 1031, as we sometimes call it. How do those conversations go with you when you're sitting down with a client who has a deal or a couple deals that have exited? What sort of things do you look for?
That's precisely it, Tay. And it's more of like, hey, what is your investment thesis? That's where we try to like zero in on first as an advisor is like, hey, what are they actually like? What do you want to do? Right? Like, how do you want to grow over the next 2 to 5 years? Right? Do you really want a lake house, a short-term rental? Okay, cool. Here's how we can take the tax advantage of that. Are you really just growing to get more returns, right? You want to like just focus on that while being hands-off simultaneously? Okay, let's do another syndication investment. We can't do a 1031, just FYI, everybody. That's the only no-no in that case. But are you interested in the capital opportunity zones, right? It's like, is that our qualified opportunity zone? Sorry, yeah. Are you interested in doing some of those type of investments, right? Where it's a long-term hold, don't get me wrong, but massive benefits in the meantime with that, right? And so it's just all those conversations, basically like finding out what your investment thesis is. All right, and then how do we reduce the cost of taxes at the end of the day?
And this is so much more lifestyle aligned versus just shoving money into a 401k or brokerage account and investing it in stocks for maximum possible appreciation to enjoy sometime 30 years from now. You know, this is so much more dynamic, and I think it's more fun, but
100%.
And obviously it's not your entire portfolio, as we've said many times, but you know, we just love it.
It's a chess game, right? Like this is basically a chess game to reduce the cost of tax. Right. And like let's say this too, is like I'm all about reducing the cost of taxes when it makes sense, right? Like we don't want to do things just to do things and reduce and not ever say taxes, right? Like that's one thing too, is you see a lot of people getting real estate, get really excited about it. Don't take a second to analyze the deal in of itself, right? And like make sure that they're okay with not getting a ton of cash flow, but also being able to capitalize on the appreciation over time.
I've also seen people get way too into real estate to the point where they're completely illiquid. And you know, they're basically they're house poor or rental property poor, where they've got, you know, a really solid net worth, but you know, they can't take a vacation because they don't have the cash flow to support it. So, you know, there are issues with that. And this is where you're getting it with that tax planning professional and sort of really designing a lifestyle, designing like where are you going? What are you trying to do in the next 5-10 years? And you can design your investment strategy around it to build either cash flow, or if you don't care about the cash flow, build for long-term wealth. How are we going to mitigate taxes on the way out? Is it through an opportunity zone? Is it through, you know, going into a DST, a Delaware statutory trust, which we've talked about on the show? Is it through, you know, just holding all these assets, or, you know, rolling it into a big multifamily deal that you just hold as a legacy asset, and then you pass it down to your kids, and then they get the step up in basis? There's all these nuances that you can talk through and match your investing strategy to the lifestyle that you're trying to create.
Yeah, 100%. That's what it comes down to, right? It's like we have to like, I like to, like tax planning is liquid, right? The plan and like the plan that we choose today, right, for 1 to 3 years might change, right? You never know, right? And it might be totally different 3 to 5 years because who knows what happens with family, career, et cetera. It could be cool. I'm making way more money than I ever thought I would be. Awesome. Let's change that. Well, I want to spend more time with the family. All right. So we got to adjust how that looks so you can maintain the same lifestyle, right? Like it's everyone has life, different things going on in life. We just got to adjust. That's all it really comes down to.
That's it.
It's been a great show. Yeah. Nathan, I know that you have some of these in the wild case studies where there's supposedly like this tax smart investor or sponsor that kind of got into big trouble. Tell us one of your stories. I love this kind of stuff to learn from what other mistakes have been made.
Yeah. So once upon a time, I had someone come by and they were telling me about, well, they own this really big, who like basically they had their own, they had this big business, right? It was a dealer. It was like a tractor dealership type thing. And so they had this tractor dealership. And then they also were like, well, I'm going to go buy short-term rentals because I keep hearing on this podcast that it saves you tons of money. I'm like, they're telling me all this information. Yeah. We bought our office space. I'm like, oh man, maybe there's like a lot of opportunity here. It's like, okay, cool. When did you actually get that short-term rental place and service? Well, we didn't have our first day until 2026. I go, oh, okay. So that changes the game when we're talking about for 2025 now. And they go, well, yeah, look, we've never done a cost like on this 2024. Okay, cool. Did you ever do this like grouping election or anything like that? And they go, oh no, we never did that either. I was like, okay, cool. Oh, well, shoot. Well, there's just a lot of like,
cool.
Yeah, not, it's actually not cool, yeah. But it's a lot of, there's like, basically it's like, there's a lot of like, you got to work with your advisor on the front end of things. Unfortunately, this person had never gotten advice from their advisor, and like despite literally begging for it and saying they'll pay whatever fee they want to get the advice. And so you got to work with someone hand in hand together to maximize these types of things, right? That way you don't just go out and do something and then you do it. That's fantastic. How do we, someone who, like we talked about earlier with the limited partner, you go, great, I'm gonna get all these depreciation deductions, but you're not a real estate professional. And there's no way that we can pull those into your loss bucket basically that way. And so it's like having that conversation on the front end so you don't make investments expecting some kind of return that you don't get back, right? So that's one example that I've seen. There's another one that I've seen where someone was someone in the family passed away. And so like, let's say a nephew, like is now going through the estate, going through the tax returns. He's business savvy. So he's like, I should probably do this. And he goes through and he's like, man, my great uncle had like all kinds of real estate. He was capitalizing on all this type of, like he basically built up his own family's empire of real estate. But I keep hearing that you guys talk about this -9 election on there, but I've never seen it on my return one time. And actually you mentioned that net investment income tax. And I see that a lot of tax being generated from that actually. What are your thoughts on that? And looking at it and seeing that over a 10-year period, never once having done the reps, like never once claiming reps despite having done it, not taking the deductions and then getting hit with net investment income tax improperly as well at the same time. So those are just a few of the crazy in the wild stories that I've seen. We could go into more, but that's just a few that I've seen that unfortunately, some of them we can fix, right? This is like to say, like not everything's permanent in the tax code. I'll say, be careful if anyone ever says, oh yeah, I'm electing out of bonus depreciation for you. Be very careful.
Electing what?
Out of bonus depreciation. So sometimes that's actually like an auto default on TurboTax actually. It says, okay, cool. Check this box to elect out of bonus depreciation. And once you do that, you can't go back and fix it. We can amend tax returns. You can amend and go back and reclaim and ask for the IRS to refund you for your net investment income tax. They're going to ask why, just what FYI, could be the start of an audit. But the revoking out of not electing out of bonus depreciation, we can't go back and fix that. That is permanent forever and ever.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Oof.
Eesh. Did not know that.
Well, and these are the little expensive mistakes that can occur when you're sort of flying blind. And
right.
And to your point, I mean, Tate, the question you asked earlier about like, when does it make sense to get a CPA? It's like when you start making these chess moves, it probably makes sense. Right. And so if you're just getting started, you're not doing anything too tricky, you don't have any complications in your life, probably not a bad idea to just TurboTax it or do it with your local CPA. But yeah.
Extensions and amendments. So we're coming up. This is going to air right about tax day. I know a lot of pilots are out there, you know, scrambling to get their K-1s, you know, the ones that were delivered on time and get their taxes filed. Can you just talk through what an extension entails and what an amendment looks like? Because we do have some investors who are expecting a big tax refund and they don't want to wait until the summer to file their taxes. They want to get that big refund now, but they're going to have a K-1 that trickles in late. So first, can we tackle the extension piece and, you know, is that a big deal? Is it not a big deal? You know, do rich people extend their taxes every year? This is kind of a rhetorical question. And then what does the process of amending look like?
Yeah. So actually, in regards to the extension process, we actually did a podcast about that released this week, actually, about what that process looks like. And honestly, how it's not a big deal. If you want to talk about audit flags, that is the least audit flag, in my opinion. And why? Because you extend your tax return to actually then file an accurate tax return, not to wait to rush everything together, do it all the midnight before and then file it and go, oh, crap, I way overclaimed or I way underclaimed. Right? We don't want to do that. The extension effectively just keeps us from suffering the failure to file penalty, which is a 5% penalty of your tax due. And that begins every single month, starting the month of April, right? They say, oh, it's a half month. Guess what? We're going to count that as a full month. So it continues to accrue up to 25% of your tax due. If you have a refund, you actually don't have to sweat this. But if you're not going to have a refund, I highly recommend filing it and just file the extension, to be completely honest. Makes your life easier, makes your life easier. You don't have to sweat it. It just gives you breathing room, if that makes sense.
And as a pro tip, I mean, I reached out to you in January with all the different entities that we needed to extend. And it was like, we took care of the extensions in January.
Yep.
So it's like, hey, there is no deadline looming on April 15th. Doesn't mean you have to wait until September, October 15th to file. Right. You can do it next month. Right. But you just don't have this hard deadline looming of April 15th.
And honestly, if you're listening to the show and you're actioning anything that we're doing on here, like short-term rentals, syndications, K-1s, diversification, all this stuff, guys, you're going to file an extension. Just get over it. Change your elections so that you don't have a big tax refund coming.
Yes, correct.
You know, talk to your CPA, of course, not giving advice, but the, you know, you're going to file an extension. It's not a big deal. I've filed an extension for the last decade.
Yep.
And you're going to reduce your audit risk, and you're not going to have to rush and stress in the middle of April to do these things, right?
And you're going to be able to get a hold of your CPA because they're not going to be nearly as busy in the late spring and into the summer as they are right now.
You're going to be your CPA's best friend. If you want to like get file in May, June, they're going to love that.
Yeah. And here's the thing, guys. I know that we're all pilots and we're all like type A and we want to get everything done and be on time and all this stuff. I get that. But let me just tell you, the wealthiest top investors that I work with don't file their tax returns until September, October timeframe. So like the smartest people, these people are very successful. They're very driven, right? So just know, like, as you start to get more assets, different types of assets in your portfolio, this is not a big deal. This is not a big deal. And I would just sort of plan that kind of going in. Now, it's not to say that me and Tate are not busting our butts to get these out in March.
We hammer to get, to get these K-1s out on time.
100%. I mean, I have a daily conversation with my CPA. And so it's not that we're not doing it. It's just that, you know, you should just, there's a lot of complications that go into 100%. Getting these things done. And sometimes they don't come out by April 15th. So
I actually want to add one thing too. So just FYI on this is that, like, look, if you're a pilot and you just invest in the syndications, right? Those are just passive activity losses, right? Actually, you don't have to technically file those on time, because passive activity losses basically the IRS goes, well, if it affects your tax due, you have to include it on the return. If it's a carryover item, you actually don't have to, I recommend waiting just so that you make sure it gets updated every single year. But if you're like, hey, I'm hot to trot, I got to get my refund, you can actually file and then just make sure you amend the carry forward of that loss for the next year. That is totally possible to do.
That's such a big tip. And that's what I've offered to our investors. This, you know, I said, hey, our K-1s haven't, you know, some of them, if you need to get an estimate of a gain or a loss, let us know. And really, it's just, you want to know one or the other. Is it a gain or is it a loss? If it's a loss, you don't really need to do anything. You can file it and carry on like you suggested, Nathan. I love that.
If it's a gain, you can always count on Ryan and I to over-communicate that, because that is a very, very important thing. If you haven't heard anything, you can assume it's a loss, because we're going to scream and yell and bang drums if there is a gain.
Yeah, totally.
Last thing I want to talk about, Nathan, before we sign off, is the amendment. What does that process look like? Let's say that you file and you get a couple K-1s that show it, that trickle in like, I don't know, June, July. You give those to your CPA. What does that amendment process look like?
Yeah, real fast. If they're all passive, right? All passive. You don't have to do any amendments, actually. You're good to go there. You don't have to do any amendments. You just update your carryovers and you're fine. There's no need to amend a tax return in that situation. If you do have to amend, there's two options. This is why I still recommend doing the 48-60 extension. If you extend your tax return, you have the ability to supersede, which means you basically just tell the IRS, I'm replacing this electronic file that I sent already with the current one, with the most updated information. You're allowed to do that so long as you have an extension that's been filed. That's why we do it for pretty much all of our clients. Every firm does it for all of their clients, right? They might not tell you they do it, but they all do it, right? So that's that. So those are those two little nuggets. The other one is, if you do have to amend, now you have to go through the process and say, okay, great. I'm now telling the IRS I'm filing a 1040X, and that is actually going to become now basically showing the adjustments from the original return to the current return, right? Either it's increase in income or decrease in income, but it's a new brand new tax return that may or may not cost, depending on the provider you work with, right? It could be an additional cost that you have to wind up incurring to do that.
Excellent advice. Well, hey, we want to be respectful of your time, especially right now, the week before the April 15th deadline. Thank you so much for joining us, Nathan. Always a pleasure. And if you want to reach out to Hall CPA, we have a link in the show notes. You can schedule an introductory call. You're probably not going to be able to get anything on the books prior to the deadline, which, as this is airing, is probably tomorrow or today. But highly recommend you guys. You're fantastic. And I can wholeheartedly say that I love working with you.
Thanks, Tate. Glad being on.
Likewise.
Thanks again, Nathan.
Catch you on the next one.